Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
So in this week's podcast, what we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about health.
Yes, from two different scenarios. One is an NHS health initiative, which is proving quite controversial with Alexa. And the other one is a CTO interview I did with a guy called Ricky Dolphin from Cambridge Cognition on their clinical trials technology.
Cool. And Claire, tea?
Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about Wettard of Chelsea, proprietor of some of Britain's favourite tea. And I'm also going to be talking about a lady called Deborah Kirkman, who's the CEO of a games testing company called Poll to Win.
Cool. I'm going to talk about All Power to the Workers. The voice of the employee software and programmes to try and make sure employees don't leave prematurely, which is a big problem for companies who are exploiting workers. But let's start with health and Alexa.
Good. So it seems like barely a week goes by at the moment without Matt Hancock announcing another one of his crackpot crazy tech schemes.
Oh, he's got to get in there.
So already we've had his determination to axe the facts.
We should invite him on the podcast.
Yes. That would be so cool.
I think I'd just go silent. So yeah, he wants to axe the facts, pulverize paper and eradicate pages, but now he's also looking to cull keyword searches. So he doesn't want people using keyboards anymore to find out information online about the NHS. He has announced a technology tie-up with Amazon that will enable people to use Alexa and therefore voice controls to search for information about any ailments they may or may not have.
So it's an Alexa skill?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
So it's basically, like I say, you will go, Alexa, why does my head hurt? And then and then you will get served up information vocally by Alexa saying, oh, your head may hurt because you've got a migraine or and stuff like that.
It's probably better than searching on WebMD and thinking that you're dying the whole time.
Well, yeah, usually it is just kind of, yeah, Dr. Google, if you want to bring up another one. It's like, yeah, it's cancer. Whoa. Thanks for that.
So you should already be dead.
Our better self, Alexa, just doesn't respond.
Yeah,
she's like, oh, she's like, I don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, I don't want to break the bad news, no. But you do not have much time left. So, but yeah, this is essentially an accessibility play, or that's how it's been pitched by the NHS as a means that, you know, although there is a lot of information now online that the NHS is providing for people to kind of reduce the amount of burden of people going to GP appointments, maybe needlessly, or trying to find out what's wrong with them. Their idea is that we'll put a lot of this information online, but not everybody might be able to access it because, you know, elderly people might not be as digitally literate, or people with sight impairments. So if you use voice controls, they can serve up the information that way.
Okay.
So it sounds quite nice, but there's been a lot of controversy about this plan this week. A lot of opposition, a lot of people are like, hey, privacy, guys. Like, how is this going to work? How is this safe? And I think a lot of it, Amazon and the NHS have come out and sort of said, right, okay, so from a privacy point of view, any data that you share about any medical conditions you're having with Alexa, all the data will be encrypted. It's not going to be used by Amazon it won't be commercialised by Amazon. It won't be used to sell products to you.
Mm.
You know, if you announce, oh, I've got Apple's foot, like, here, have a foot sock. Yeah, no, that's not going to happen. That's what they've said. So there's been sort of opposition from that point of view.
But was that, were they specific about, oh, I suppose if it's NHS, then that's UK, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they did the same thing in the US, then there's probably not as much guarantee that that wouldn't happen because of the way that the healthcare system is different.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, it's a lot more, well, everything's paid for over there.
Yeah.
So there's probably is more kind of a commercial tie-in or like, oh, I see you've been charged this by your hospital. Do you think you could get bandages cheaper in a bulk buy on Amazon? So that's potentially a thing. But also in America as well, particularly, Amazon is building out its healthcare business,
right,
which I think we've talked about on the podcast before. So I think that's another element to this. People are like, oh, so they're getting their hands on the NHS.
Yeah.
So is this a way of them getting their claws in now so they'll bring more of their healthcare kind of services that are rolling out in America over here as well?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of creep of big firms taking on public sector or getting more involved in public sector. That's another bit of opposition to it all. And things like when you do an Alexa search, obviously it's saved onto your device, like whoever's account it is, that data is served. So there's been a couple of examples that have been shared in the press around say if a young girl uses the family Alexa to ask for help on contraception and things like that, if it's the dad's account and she doesn't want him knowing about that, could he see that search and could there be kind of repercussions for...
At least she's searching for him.
Well, exactly. But, it's... And I think stuff like that, it's like, yeah, it's an issue, but then shouldn't there... If you're a good parent, you would know that your child might be requiring things like that.
It's a bit Black Mirror, isn't it?
I wonder if people are doing this already. Is there any indication that, people are already kind of interacting in this way with Alexa, and so therefore it's an opportunity? Or...
Well, I don't know, like Claire said, it's probably just an Alexa skill, and there's so many out there, so there probably are other elements, but they probably won't be just limited to data from the NHS. It might be from all over the web that it pulls it in from.
Yeah, it'll probably be safer for them to get it from the NHS for the time being, if that's like the official guidelines, because, you know, the NHS has their stance on every single illness out there.
And, well, we talked the other week about the NHS app on the podcast, which I downloaded. Yeah. And it's it's actually really useful.
Is it good?
Yeah, you can book, like, appointments with your... it's really easy to sign up for. God, I'm going to do the sales
pitch. You're doing
now.
A pitch.
Yeah, it is really easy. There's loads of security stuff to get through to make sure you are who you say you are, and that, you know, the surgery you're saying I'm a part of can verify that you are who you say you are, and stuff like that. But you can book appointments, like, out of hours, and then once the... say the opening hours of the doctor's surgery come online, you get confirmation and stuff
so
like that.
So you don't have to pick up the phone and you're still there half an hour later.
Yeah, and you don't have to disclose. You don't have to disclose to the receptionist. Like, why are you calling? Like, I've got a bit of a rash and it's oozing. I'm really uncomfortable.
Fascinating. Tell me more.
So you get out of all that. So there is, I guess, also potential maybe if people are seeing, like, oh, well, what if they tie up this service eventually with the app?
Yeah.
And things like that. So I don't know. This is all conjecture at this point. At the moment, they've just said there's no medical information. You know, it's not linked to your medical files. It's just if you want to do a search, this is it. And I think there is a sense within, probably from some of the reactions from the government and the NHS on this, that everyone's kind of blown it all a bit out of proportion. Like, it's just a way of getting information.
Yeah.
But, so it's been lots to unpick with that this week.
Do you think we'll be using it? Can you see yourself using this?
I don't have an Alexa.
Oh, well.
I'm an Apple household.
Yeah. But then it might... Well,
the principle of the thing, though, just kind of talking to a device about you...
I don't think so.
Your health information is like probably the most personal information about you. So
it is.
So who would want to read that out? Like, you're in a coffee shop, like, with your phone. Like, Alexa, please. Like, why is this happening to me?
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that out loud.
In fact, if I do any health searches, I do it in private browsing mode on my phone as well.
Yeah.
I don't want it to turn up in any kind of, like, suggestions or...
Yeah.
Mm. But also, a lot of your browsers now are linked to whatever devices you sign in on. So if you did like a search like that, and then it turns up on your work computer, and then like the IT admins at TechTarget are like, maybe we need to look into Claire and just make sure she's okay.
Suddenly you get an Instagram advert for some kind of ointment.
Yeah.
Not that I need any ointment. Let's move on.
Let's move on to some more health.
More health, yeah, I'm just very health crazed today. But I did a really interesting CTO interview last week, which kind of touched on a theme that we have talked about on the podcast previously, but from a slightly different dimension, which is kind of alternative uses for technology. So we've talked about in the past around like the misappropriation of technologies by kind of dangerous parties. So artificial intelligence falling into the wrong hands, and you know, technologies being designed for one purpose and then being used in an alternative way that might not have been positive. So I spoke to the CTO a couple of weeks ago from Cambridge Cognition called Ricky Dolphin, and he sort of made the point that, you know, not sometimes finding alternative uses for technology isn't always...
I'm sorry, that is just a fabulous name.
I know.
Mr. Dolphin.
I know, it kind of makes me think like I need a much better name like to go about my career with, but never mind. Just have to stick with what I've got. So he sort of made the point that, you know, it's not always a bad thing. Sometimes using technologies outside of, like, thinking outside the box with how technology should be used can bring sort of business benefits and, benefits for society. And he's, over the years, loads of products that were designed for one purpose, but they've also ended up being widely successful elsewhere.
Like, for example, virtual reality. I mean, like, everybody thought that its best use case would be in gaming, but really it's doing a lot in sort of like the training space in dangerous situations, you know, like fire people.
Yes.
That's a great example.
Fire officers being trained about, you know, like emergency situations. You can't really replicate those.
No.
And there were others that I can't remember now. But,
Stuff definitely.
Like that. Yeah, so he was kind of making the case in this, during our interview, that, you know, technology leaders, but also technology companies, shouldn't just think we've designed a technology for one purpose. It can only be used that way. So, and this is all within the context of something that his company does. They make software that underpins clinical trials specifically for people who are having conditions relating to brain health. So brain health difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, I guess sort of multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's and stuff like that.
Okay.
So their software helps manage the clinical trials, and it also helps kind of help companies like big pharma, healthcare organisations select patients to participate in these trials as well.
Mm-hmm.
And due to the nature of the conditions that they are tracking and monitoring as this, a lot of them are quite debilitating. Sometimes they're incurable, they're very rare. So he was saying that there is sometimes a mental health element that needs tracking as well, because you know, they might be suffering from depression and anxiety and things like that.
Yeah.
So one thing that's come forth a few times from some of their clients is that we need kind of a foolproof way of monitoring people's mental health, but particularly around suicide prevention, because, you know, the people are prone to that when they're suffering from those issues. So they've tried, there's lots of different technologies out there, he sort of made the point, you know, it could be, so if someone is feeling that way, they will be given a questionnaire to fill in, so that the clinician who's looking after them can sort of get a sense of, you know, what their risk is for suicide.
Yeah.
And so from that, it's usually the clinician it's up to the clinician to sort of make a call that, okay, I think we need to escalate this up or get someone to take action. But he was sort of saying that in some of those instances, you don't want it just to rely on that one clinician to make that call.
Also, those the surveys, the check boxes, you just can lie. I don't know if you've ever seen them.
Yeah.
But they say things like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how suicidal have you felt in the last week? And you can just be like, not at all.
Yeah, well, it is all done down to self-reporting. I did sort of say that. So it's not like you've got, you know, sort of brain sensors saying, oh, I think, yeah, we can sort of self, you know, we can detect here. So it's, yeah,
it's in the future.
Yeah, So
it's still the case.
Yeah, it's still self-reporting. So it's, so in some in some settings, like I say, it will be down to a clinician, but they want the ability to be able to call in someone quite quickly to make, as he said, a backstop, just in case, like, what do you think? Okay, what do we need? What action do we need to take to help this person right now? But then in other settings, a lot of these clinical trials now done in the home as well. So it's kind of like you need to add support there. That if a clinician isn't present, that escalation can still happen and they can get the help they need.
Yeah.
So they were thinking, okay, so what technology can we introduce? And they were saying, like, SMS technology, you just say, oh, we'll just send a message. Doesn't really work because there's no guarantee that anyone actually picks it up in time.
Yeah.
So they're like, that won't work. They said there's like hospital systems that are used to alert hospital personnel within a hospital, like, oh, this might happen. It's up, but again, it doesn't have the escalation element. It's really this escalation bit they need. So within Cambridge Cognition's business, they already use PagerDuty's alert system, instant alert monitoring system,
okay,
which is used to sort of monitor the health of their IT infrastructure and their cloud infrastructure, making sure everything's online that should be.
Yeah.
And if it's not, an alert gets sent to like an IT operations person somewhere, and they're like, oh, I should act on that. But if they don't respond, it gets escalated up to another person who might be on call. And if they don't respond, it gets escalated up to, say, someone in senior management who will probably give them a telling off for not picking up their phone and acting on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes up a chain of command. So they are repurposing that technology to help in suicide prevention. So they said, you know, it's kind of a tweak of the APIs, I think a little bit of support from PagerDuty and tweaking the licensing so that they get all the functionality they need for this, but that's kind of an example of what they're doing.
I see, and they were maybe led to think along those lines because they are involved in healthcare in a way, because they're providing the clinical trials tech. Their heads were in that space.
He's a big advocate for, like, say, not necessarily thinking, okay, well, this is what technology is designed for, let's put it up, use it other way. So that's kind of what society societal benefit, he said. But
does he have a PhD or is he a medical doctor?
I don't actually
know. Dr. Dolphin.
Dr. Dolphin.
Mm. Would be perfect.
Yeah, he's...
Mr. Dolphin's good too, though.
Yeah. I don't know, actually. We didn't get onto that during the conversation.
Mm. Imagine, like, a TV programme. Dr. Dolphin, here he comes, he's saving the day with tech that's not for tech.
Perfect.
There we go. Get it commissioned. Get that on our screen.
So many ideas we generate for these companies.
Those, yeah.
Goldmine.
You're welcome.
Sitting on. Yeah. So, So I just thought, I thought it was just really interesting. But the write-up for it will hopefully be appearing either later this week, or probably early next week when the podcast goes out. So,
cool.
Nice.
Well, mental health is very serious, you know. Business. Nice cup of tea can help, though.
Sometimes, all you need is a
bit of tea and sympathy.
Cup of tea, yeah.
Yeah, a cup of Rosie Lee.
Go, Cockney.
Yeah, nice Cockney cuppa. Wittard of Chelsea. So this is a case study that I wrote a little while ago that's appearing in the e-zine this week.
It's appearing in the e-zine this week, yeah.
So, really, really old company. Yeah. Founded in the 1800s. Survived,
and they got bombed, didn't they, as well?
Two world wars.
Mm.
And until 2008.
Uh-oh, what world war happened?
Don't you remember that one?
God, I've had my head down. I might have missed something.
You missed the whole world. In 2008, the company went into administration and was bought out. Part of the process when they were bought out is that they decided to sort of like jiggle around with the stores a little bit. So they reduced the number of stores and now they're quite flexible in seeing like whether a store will work before they decide whether they're going to keep it up and running or not. So if it doesn't fit sort of like the location or the clientele, they just move it or close it. So they've drastically reduced the number of stores, which I guess you could say is in line with the current retail space in a technological era. So when I was speaking to the people from Wittard during the Seated Connections conference
in Madrid,
A couple of months ago, they were saying that, you know, like they're sort of catering a bit to a younger audience now as well, with things like cold tea, you know, like infusion tea.
Oh yeah.
I've seen, Caroline, that you've had that before. Is it good?
Not very nice.
But it wasn't from Wetter.
No. I like a herbal tea, but not cold. Yeah. Just not. I've not got to that point in my life yet.
Yeah, you tried it, didn't like it. Gonna move on.
Mm-hmm.
So as well as skewing to sort of like a younger audience with products like that, despite the fact that, you know, they said everybody loves a cup of tea, everybody is our target audience. And they're also trying to sort of modernise some of the technology that they offer. So stuff like click and collect,
mm-hmm.
or click and reserve, electronic receipts,
okay.
And they're doing that with sort of like a combination of Sajid and Salesforce Commerce Cloud. And then they were talking about expanding into China as their current project.
How ironic.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's more sort of a brand thing than the tea in particular, you know.
Yeah.
Not that China needs any more tea.
I was going to say, it's quite an ambitious. I remember a few years ago on The Apprentice, there was a task where they had to set up a food market in France, and they bought loads of cheese and tried to British cheese and tried to sell it in France. And they're like, "What are you doing?" But so it kind of reminded me of that.
I think they're doing a bit better than that.
Well, it wouldn't have to go work do very. I can't even speak. Yeah.
And they're
cool.
And Claire, they're looking at that customer data too, aren't they?
Yeah, so they're using data analytics. I think that they said they were using a firm called Click, basically to just improve the way that staff produce reports. So I think that they were having a little bit of an issue with people being unable in the company to sort of act on reports that they were producing, and now that they've got, you know, like the data analytics in. They can actually use the data.
I love this quote from their chief financial officer, Nathan Smith, who said, so staff produce reports and I ask, what does it say? And they reply, I don't know. It's obviously a kind of an inspirational point for him to move into customer data analytics with Click.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
So lots of different technologies to achieve lots of newfangled things.
Yeah, although it's tea is a very old commodity.
Yeah.
And also I think they're quite into the whole idea of it's an experience.
Yeah, experiential. Like you say, good cuppa, sit down with a good cuppa and then beat it.
This has been a big theme for you, hasn't it, Claire? These kind of, you know, shops becoming, leading more on the experience, potential and building community and all that.
Yeah, exactly. And if you've ever visited a Wittard shop as well, they always have a sample on the go. You know, like there'll always be a new kind of like tea or powder to try.
Yeah.
You can go in and they do tableware as well. So you can buy, you know, like sometimes the mug that you have a cup of tea out of can make all of the difference.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Definitely.
So stuff like that as well.
So Caroline was talking to a cool CTO called Dolphin.
Mr.
And
Dolphin.
And you have been talking to a cool CEO.
Yes.
Yeah.
Called Deborah Kirkman, as mentioned.
Ah.
So the company that she is CEO for, Poll to Win, they do a lot of stuff like games testing, you know, like among some things, you know, quality assurance and stuff. But what I thought was more interesting about our chat was we were talking about women in tech and women in gaming, because the gaming space hasn't always been known to be very friendly for women. So we were just having a bit of a chat about that. And she told me a story. Basically, she's a single mum. She's been working at Poll to Win for quite a while. And then she was like, do you know what? I'm going to homeschool my child and, you know, take her around the world with me. Like, as she's moved up the company, she's had to do a lot more travelling and she's just decided to be flexi and take her child around the world with her. And she said that she always has to bring an army of Barbie dolls to keep her daughter amused. But yeah, so I thought that was really cool. She was on a visit to London. And she was also saying that they have an office in India that has a lot of night shifts. But they noticed that not as many women were taking the night shifts because they felt that it was sort of unsafe to be out at those kinds of hours. So they got security guards and shuttle services to take them to and from the office to help improve the experience for women. Obviously, you know, like night shifts pay more as well.
Yeah, so they're missing out economically if they don't partake.
Exactly. So yeah, they did that to make sure that the women could participate as equally as the men in the night shifts. And then she said that if she could give any advice to women in tech or women in gaming, it would be fearless, know your worth, ask for a seat at the table, and find good mentors who will help you find your path. And I told her that I wanted to get it written on a plaque and put it up in my living room.
Cool. Did you meet her face to face?
No, this was over the phone. I was meant to meet her face to face, but I accidentally booked in the first judging round for our Computer Weekly Most Influential Women in UK Tech at the same time, so I was a bit.
Well, nothing's perfect.
My bad.
But it was
very nice.
Yeah.
But it was interesting, the things you mentioned, like in terms of childcare, that's one of the
very
the biggest impediments you hear. Like for people, particularly because tech work is, there is a lot of travel involved. So in terms of like some conferences you go to, a lot of them will, or not a lot of them actually, not, it sticks out because so few do it, that it's got crashes and stuff sort of appearing now.
Yeah.
Which is not something, you know, that was really apparent like,
that
for
is,
me a few
that
years
is
ago.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a misspent youth as a political activist.
I didn't
know this. That was just an absolute norm to have a crash. And we're talking, don't want to age myself too much, but this is the 1980s. So, but tech conferences, which I've been to many, many of those.
Well, it's a fair point. They have poppy pens, but they don't have anywhere to put your children.
Literally what I was about to just say. You can pet a puppy, but you can't take a kid with you.
I mean, OpenStack, I go to their conference every year, and they do. I think there's been a few instances where they have had, they've been able to, I think it obviously depends on the.
Have we stumbled upon something yet?
It is quite difficult though. You know, probably insurance purposes don't help, right?
I was going to say, some of it comes down to the venue, so I think like say I've been to some OpenStack conferences, I think from memory where they have had them, and then other ones where they haven't, and I think that is due to probably like say insurance or whatever, just like we can't have children running around here.
Yeah, and then you need to hire someone who can actually take care of the kids as well, because you can't just leave them in a soft play area and go and do your day.
Yeah, it's long days at conferences. I'm sorry, I can't look after them. I've got a keynote.
You're like, I'll be back between 2 and 3, we can talk then.
No, it's definitely something I think needs
very
to be addressed.
Important.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're basically, it's not just women though.
Yeah.
I hate to sound like that, but like
it's
not just women.
It would be helpful to everyone.
But yeah, like if you've got childcare commitments, and a lot of these conferences don't happen during school holidays anyway, but if you've got young children, you are kind of, I don't want to say lumbered, but you are limited in what you can do and where you can go, and probably career opportunities. You know, huge networking opportunities at conferences and stuff that you're missing out on because that could help you further your career because you can't physically go because of childcare.
Yeah, because people with kids have to factor them in, schedule their lives around, you know, like dividing the pickup times and when you're looking after them, and it would just be so much easier if we could be a little bit more accommodating.
And obviously the travel costs of travelling with a much bigger party as well, not just you.
A bigger party.
Child entourage. But
So... Yeah, I think it's just thinking about employees and so on, and how, you know, things should be better in terms of creches at conferences and employee retention and all that. There's a really good feature published this week by Kath Everett, which we entitled Forward Thinking Companies Are Listening to Employees. I mean, the business problem here really is retention, is holding on to your staff. And a lot of... maybe especially startup companies, but actually it'd be an across the board thing, possibly a generational thing, that younger employees tend to move on more quickly than in the past. But in any case, companies are trying to solve this problem of losing the people that they have spent so much time and money recruiting in the first place and trying to hang on to them. So, yeah, Voice of the Employee is the name that's been given to this category of software and service.
Okay.
I guess derived from, like, Voice of the Customer. So it's modelled a bit on kind of customer retention, customer loyalty, and applying that concept to employees.
It sounds like another episode of Dr. Dolphin. He uses tech for something that he doesn't mean to use it for.
Perfect. Yeah, another adaptation. And all of this tech is about just getting more regular feedback, rather than just the annual survey.
Yeah.
That a lot of companies do. I'm just looking at both of you. Do we do this? I'm not. Do we?
I don't think so.
Employee survey.
No. I have suggested we introduce a suggestions box. But
anyway, there are companies that do.
Yeah.
So
we had a... Yeah.
I don't know where I put that suggestion because we don't have a box.
Send an email out to the ether.
Yeah.
But I think one of the more advanced ideas here is to move on from that to, doing sentiment analytics. If you're using something like Yammer or other collaborative software, or you could apply to email, to anything digital.
Well, weren't you talking about this a couple of weeks ago about SurveyMonkey?
Yeah.
When they're doing something similar.
SurveyMonkey.
Well, yeah, it's kind of, using, polling things. Because, you know, it's one thing, I think, to fill in a survey and say, I'm not happy about the company. And that's probably a bit more liberating than thinking, right, okay, I have to walk into the boss's office and say, I'm not happy about this in person. It's quite intimidating. So I think it's a way of letting people share their thoughts and maybe frustrations, but in a way that they feel comfortable with, so they can seem...
Anyway, apparently it is very hot in HR, software HR, circles, this Voice of the Employee thing, but it's the usual thing of it being early days. That's what they always say, isn't it? It's early days for this. And some of the analysts that Kath talked to said maybe 5 years from now. I wonder if there's less of a commercial imperative, because getting the voice of the customer and making more money out of your customers, is that more of a business imperative than hanging on to your staff?
Well, I don't know if people.
I suppose you want to do both.
Yeah, but if people aren't feeling happy and engaged with where they work, they're not going to be as productive and generate as much money for you.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, from the customer point of view, it's like, how do we make more money out of you guys? You know, it's. I think there's. Yeah, there's definitely. Yeah, I think it's probably. Well, depends who the company is, but yeah. I'd say they're equal.
You waste a lot of time and effort recruiting new people, onboarding them. Mm. If you have really good people who are happy and doing their best work and you just leave them up to it, surely that saves money.
Mm.
And there are two case studies that Kath talks about. A little British company called Totally Money,
who
provide products to help people improve their credit scores, and FIS Global, which is a big global, financial services oriented IT services software consultancy outsourcing based in Florida. But yeah, I always think of this as being a really big company solution, though. Because, I mean, if you've only got a handful of employees, why would you need to be monitoring their Yammer activity or even surveying them on a regular basis? But if you've got a really big organisation.
Well, I don't know. It happens in all companies of all sizes, I think. You just have to be a bit more careful about that anonymity in a smaller company, I guess, because it's very easy to be like, well, I know that was you that said that.
Must have been you said that, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, all the kind of rhetoric here is about it's anonymous and it's aggregated and so on and so forth. But there must be some element of, I mean, if you're using sentiment analytics on, you know, like, as if you were to apply that to Twitter, but use that on Yammer or whatever, even email conversations, that does seem a little bit Big Brother-y.
Yeah, because also it's, could something someone say, it's always a problem, isn't it? Something perhaps someone says in jest being misinterpreted, and then like, oh, so you think the company's doing really badly here? Oh no, it's not, yeah, if it's anonymous, it's fine, but if it's not, yeah, could that person be penalised, or unfairly penalised because the sentiment's been misinterpreted?
Yeah, that's what I mean about, you know, especially in a smaller company, you have to make sure that you get your privacy about.
Yeah. It's a good piece. I'd like to see more about employees being empowered just for the sake of it, rather than for hanging on to them and keeping them for as long as possible to make more money out of them. But there you go, that's the world we live in. But a couple of stories this week. We have fought back against, or somebody's fought back against, big corporates. Finally, a couple of decent fines.
Oh.
One applied to British Airways.
Oh, yeah.
And another applied to Marriott.
Our hotel chain.
Security correspondent Warwick Ashford covered these two. The BA one was very much in on the BBC and in media and mainstream media early this week. Marriott, I wasn't so aware of that one. Well, anyway, it was.
Because they were both ICO fines, weren't they?
They were both ICO fines.
So I think there's this kind of like, oh, things come in threes, so what's the next one?
Yeah.
You know, they've obviously decided, right, summer clampdown, let's get going. So
there's someone messing up right now.
Yeah.
And they're big sums of money. I mean, the BA one is almost 200, 200 mil, 183 million. Biggest ever fine.
Yeah.
Before the GDPR, the holy GDPR, the maximum would have been 500,000. It's quite a big jump. I mean, it's not that percentage of revenue. I think it's 4% that they can. But even so, it's a big number. Marriott, 99 million. Interestingly, reading Warwick's story, The problem there seems to have been when they acquired Starwood. So it was Starwood who had the compromise originally.
Oh, okay.
But Marriott hadn't done the due diligence on Starwood. So that's a slightly different story. Another point of difference Warwick pointed up was that in the BA case, they got kudos for acting so quickly on the breach, which was last year, wasn't it? September-ish time. Marriott, similar period of time, whereas Marriott were quite kind of dithery.
And yet they got the bigger fine. Is that because they're just a bigger
fine?
Yeah.
It must be to do with the range of the information that got breached, because Marriott was a bigger number of customers. BA's case, it was 500,000 customers.
I guess it depends on what, does it depend on the data that was accessed?
Yeah, the nature of the data was, in the case of BA, it did seem to be very, you know, pretty much the whole works.
Just all of it.
Yeah, all of it.
Great.
Yeah. So that, but that's good.
Yes.
It's good that,
enforcement,
you know,
in action. Yeah. Let's do it.
There has been a lot of sentiment that the GDPR has come in, but it's not really made very much difference.
But also the ICO are kind of regularly sort of in parts of the media sort of described as being a bit toothless.
Toothless watchdog.
Could fine up to this amount, but they only ever do this amount. So just seeing them, you know, roll out their biggest ever fines is, I think, probably counteract some of that.
Yeah, but then if they were just going around fining everyone the maximum amount, everyone would be like, they're out of control. Quick, take them to the dentist, get those teeth removed.
So yeah, you can't do right for doing.
There's no winning.
Yeah.
I think that's all we've got time for this week. We're going to be catching up with our Singapore correspondent, Aaron Tan, who's visiting us briefly. So we're going to have to say goodbye, listeners. But I'll just say thank you to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Claire.
Anytime.
Thank you to you for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.